we're going to take some time and talk about cervical cancer. January is Cervical Cancer Awareness Month, and joining me are Drs. Luis Rojas and David Starks from the Avera Medical Group Gynecologic Oncology. Did I get it all right? All those C's?
You did.
I did. All right. Well, thank you for being here on Innovation. So let's start with how common is cervical cancer?
So globally, cervical cancer is the third most common cancer in women, and it's really more a cancer of women in the developing world, where screening programs have been started, but they don't work very well. And so roughly it was estimated about 2 years ago that there were about 500,000 cases globally, and about 250,000 deaths were to be expected. In the U.S., where we've had a Pap smear screening program, which a lot of women are obviously very familiar with and participate in, we've seen a drastic drop off in the last several decades of cervix cancer, and it's roughly, they anticipated about 12,000 cases about 2 years ago, with about 4,000 deaths is what we initially expected. It's not as common a cancer in the United States as it is globally.
And just to give you an idea as well, it's important to know the prevalence of the disease in the country overall is 8 cases per 100,000 women. And in this region, particularly in South Dakota, is 4 cases per 100,000 women, even though we have a small proportion of high-risk population, which is the Native American population.
They're at higher risk because they don't have screenings?
Correct.
Okay.
Not only that, but maybe because they don't tend to follow up with. When you screen, you need to follow up to make sure that the disease doesn't develop, and that probably is part of the problem.
But we also know, even nationally, minority populations, African American, Hispanic and Latino, Native Americans and Eskimos are at increased risk, but it's probably, there's as many probably social and cultural factors as there are, actual medical reasons. I don't think anybody would say that people are more genetically predisposed.
Not at all. Yeah.
Okay. And the cause for cervical cancer, do we know?
It's the only real cancer that we know the direct cause is a virus. It's an infection that's sexually transmitted, the human papillomavirus, which is involved both in the creation of genital warts, if it's the more benign type, versus the more aggressive types, which are type 16 and 18, which are the most common kinds that cause cervical cancer. But, that was kind of a huge breakthrough when they found out this was a virus that was leading to transformations as the body tried to get rid of it that actually resulted in a cancer.
There are other factors also that influence in the development. So cigarette smoking is sort of impacts the level of immunity that the body needs to clear this virus. So when you smoke and are in contact with the virus, then you are at a higher risk of having HPV that will lead to a progression into cancer.
And HPV is a sexually transmitted virus, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's, I think people are becoming more familiar with it, but it's extremely common. Now risk factors usually that people talk about is multiple sexual partners, earlier onset of sexual activity, and those are increased risk factors. But merely one person having sexual contact with a person who's had multiple other partners, you can pick up HPV. And there's been some studies that would suggest that in any given time, particularly amongst sort of sexually active female population, up to 57% of people may be infected. But particularly in the teens and 20s, where often people pick this virus up, the immune system is able to clear it. And so that's why we don't see, large-scale cervix cancer. But if the virus persists and continues to hang out in the cervix into your 30s, the body doesn't clear it at that point. And that's when we start seeing the transformation that will slowly lead to cervix cancer. So most young women probably pick it up some point in their life and their body clears it. They never knew they had it, particularly if they weren't having pap smears or anything like
that. And when's a good time to start having annual pap smears?
Well, the actual recommendations have changed over time after analyzing many, many years mm-hmm. of information and studies. Now we know that when we start too early, we end up doing a lot of unnecessary testing because the woman that becomes in contact with the virus has the immune capabilities of getting rid of it.
Okay.
Recommendations are to start at age 21. From there until age 29, we can screen every 3 years safely. That is a little bit of a point of hesitation for a lot of patients. I have patients that come to my office and say, I don't care what the guidelines say. I will pay for my pap smear every year if I have to. And we know that it is not necessary. It's a waste of resources.
And also, I mean, I think the concern, too, for women in their 20s, the new guidelines, too, don't recommend actually. When we do screening, we do a pap smear, but we also will test for high-risk human papillomavirus. Mm-hmm. That's no longer recommended in women in their 20s because, as Dr. Rojas was kind of saying, the chances that you're going to pick up that they actually have the infection are high. And then the question is, it makes us start doing more invasive things that can compromise fertility down the road or childbearing if we start cutting off part of the cervix. And the large percent of these women are going to clear that virus and never be bothered with it down the road. So there's been a move towards being more conservative because the old recommendations used to say, you know, 3 years after the onset of sexual activity. So you were seeing, you know, 16-year-olds who were having operations for something that probably their body would have gotten rid of down the road. And so we're trying to err on the side of caution.
And so what about the vaccine? The Gardasil vaccine, is that?
The Gardasil vaccine, I mean, both vaccines are supposed to protect and, in theory, help prevent about 80-90% of cancers because they are designed to protect against the most common cancer-inducing subtypes, 16, 18, 6, and 11. So it is a good thing to do. It can be done from early age, 9 to 18, but there's some recommendations that even up to 20, some years of age, it can be done as well.
Does that change the immune system if you do come in? You just won't contract the virus or you'll fight it off?
The thought is that probably your body, you know, sort of being sensitized to it, you would not really get the infection. The real question that nobody knows about is there are other high-risk types of HPV, you know, in the 30, 45, 55, that we just don't generally see because 16 and 18 are so common. There are some people who express the concern that as we immunize, will we start seeing more cases of these rarer kinds that we just don't pick up. But I think the vaccine is going to be the future. I think it probably will at some point hopefully make the screening system and the pap smear thing a thing of the past, but I don't think that that's going to happen in the next several decades. Even if people have been vaccinated, they still need to participate in the screening program.
The other concern is that we know there are studies done in minority groups, and we know that those groups have different types of high-risk HPV causing their cancers that the vaccine may not necessarily cover. Huh. And right now, we don't have really
a targeted vaccine?
Correct.
Yeah.
For those subgroups.
And so aren't we seeing more HPV in the throat cancers as well? Does the vaccine guard against that?
Presumably. I mean, I think...
We don't know.
I think, again, some of it's more sexual practices. Okay. You know, and I think probably if we see a decrease just in HPV infections, we would expect that you would see less of that as well.
A more controversial topic is since the male is sort of a vector, should we vaccinate boys?
Right.
And
isn't it approved?
It is.
It has become.
It has become approved. It is recommended. I have vaccinated two of my three boys, and because at the end, you are trying to impact this disease in the future.
I mean, because the real argument when that was first coming out was the incidence of penile cancer is minimal, and for the most part, men and boys are asymptomatic carriers of it. They spread it, but they're never affected by it. And so there were some people who argued, is it responsible to vaccinate, which may have complications that we don't know about, for something that they are not themselves at risk? And that was one camp, but another camp sort of said, you know, not all women are going to get vaccinated. Not all women are going to participate in the screening program. But if the male had been vaccinated, perhaps there wouldn't be that spread. And I think that camp is kind of won out.
Yep.
So a simple pap smear is what detects cervical cancer. But you don't really necessarily have to start it every year until you're 30?
You know, a pap smear really doesn't detect the cancer. You just detect abnormal cells.
Okay. And so then what's the next step?
Once you detect some abnormal cells, then you have to dig into it, depending on the pap smear results and the HPV typing results. So the next step will be to do a colposcopy looking for lesions that you can biopsy, and you can actually document, does the patient has a precancerous lesion or is there a cancer there already? And depending on what we find, further treatment options will come.
Okay. And how do you, what's the best way to treat cervical cancer? And how is that evolving?
Well, I mean, I think the initial thing, I mean, what Dr. Rojas is kind of saying is certainly if you can pick up these transformations early, particularly high-grade lesions that have not become cancer. The one thing we know about cervix cancer is once you have the HPV infection, if your body does not clear it, as it tries to fight it off, it kind of creates these changes in the cervix that it takes at least, they theorize, 10 years before the transformation has led to a cervix cancer. So that's part of why it's very frustrating that we still have the level of cervix cancer that we do, because with screening, there's a lag time that should allow for appropriate treatment. But as you progress through these precancerous lesions that are there, if they're not treated, ultimately it will progress to cervix cancer. The thing we really want to do in the part of the screening program is, can you intervene for these precancerous lesions, which require a lot of times just a small removal of a portion of the cervix may be enough that's required to clear it. In lower resource settings, you can freeze a portion of the cervix, and often that will destroy those lesions. Hmm. People can avoid a major surgery, and they don't have to, they don't develop cancer down the road. Cervix cancer sometimes is managed surgically. Other times, if it has become too advanced, surgery is actually the wrong thing to do, and it is treated with radiation, with chemotherapy. And the goal is always to try and find this early. I think part of what we're seeing, too, is when we do see patients who have cervix cancer, a lot of times they're coming in with what's called locally advanced disease, which is already beyond any kind of surgery at this point.
And more challenging is something that we're seeing more and more are younger patients that haven't bear children and are coming with cervix cancer. There are options for those patients that will allow us to preserve their uterus and their ovaries with the intent of having further children down the line. And those options are usually very highly specialized type of surgeries that are very scattered and only done in a few centers in the country, actually more so in Europe and Canada.
Is there a controversial treatment to this or plans? I mean, or is the U.S. just...
No,
to come.
I think it's a matter of volume. Again, in this country, there's this is not really a problem, not all places have people trained to do the surgeries. Mm-hmm. You have to have many cases referred to you so you can become proficient in doing these cases.
And I think then the problem is, it's such a small pot. You know, we're talking about young women who are of, you know, childbearing age, which already is somewhat outside of
the
what
norm.
The average age. Yep. We see the mean age for somebody with cervix cancer is in their mid-40s. Usually they're done childbearing. And so the surgery that Dr. Rojas is talking about, it's called a trachelectomy. The idea is to try and see if you can basically cut off the entire cervix to get the cancer out, somebody who has a known cancer, but to keep the uterus in, to reattach the uterus to the vagina and to put a stitch in that will allow the patient to actually get pregnant, but then they have to always be delivered by a cesarean section.
Okay.
And it's just, there's so few people who fit that bill that any one center can say we've done. I mean, when we talk about specialized centers, we're talking about people who maybe have done 15 of these surgeries.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not huge numbers, but it does allow a young woman to have an opportunity potentially to have children, not that it's without its own complications.
And there are other types of gynecological cancers too, other than just cervical cancer?
Definitely. Yeah. Cervix is our most common one is cancer of the uterus. And, okay. You know, there was a study that came out recently. In the average run-of-the-mill uterine cancer is often one of the big risk factors for it is just obesity. And as the obesity epidemic has been taking off, we're seeing more and more of these cancers are hormonally derived. And that's the most common gynecologic cancer in the United States, followed by ovary cancer, which is the most fatal of all of the cancers we deal with. And I think that's another one that gets a fair amount of attention. And then cervix is our third most common for what we deal with.
For what you see. And treatment, new treatments, new technologies for this in diagnosis or in treatment?
For the other cancer?
Yeah.
Well, treatment, minimally invasive technology has become a very important treatment. Mm-hmm. or new technology to treat endometrial cancers and some of the cervix cancer, not because it really changes how the patients do, but it changes how the patients recover from surgery and the amount of complications that a patient can have from a surgery. The big change in cancer treatment in all fields, but a very big change coming up, is the factor of genetics, molecular profiling.
That was my next question.
You talk about innovation, and that's where all research sort of aimed at. How can you identify people with a particular genetic signature that will either allow them to have a better treatment with X medication or Y medication? Or how can you genetically test and say, hey, you're going to be at risk for this in the future? We've done a great amount of progress in ovarian cancers in the genetic area, as we know that 10%, 15% of them can be genetic, and there are specific mutations that we test for. So the area of molecular testing, genetic testing, is a big part of the future of cancer treatment.
I think the famous case, you know, Angelina Jolie had BRCA and was at increased risk for breast and ovary cancer. And part of the benefit of knowing that, aside from passing on to your family, is I think what Dr. Rojas was alluding to as well, was the prophylactic operations, removal of the breasts and the ovaries, which decreases your risk of having those cancers. With uterine cancer, there's a correlation called HNPCC, which people who have colon and uterine, sometimes that can travel together in the family, and screening and treatment can be indicated for that as well. And then for the BRCA patients too, there are some new drugs that are coming up called PARP inhibitors in particular, and right now they're only on clinical trials, but it's indicated specifically for those particular mutations. And this is kind of, I think, where the future of some of this is going, where you have genetic abnormalities and drugs that are created and target those particular abnormalities. And so that's, we have a PARP inhibitor trial that we have currently going on.
Actually, we were amongst the nation up until last week. Avera Cancer Institute was the only site open for the trial in the nation when we accrued the first two patients. Now there are a couple of other sites having it. So we're, you know, very much into the innovation part of that.
Right. That was my next question, is your research projects and research studies that are happening at Avera.
So we have, you know, one of the research that I've been involved with, I think goes back to cervix cancer, and probably innovation would be tough to say, because in the United States, I'm not sure how much of an impact it'll have, but with cervix cancer being, you know, sort of a global phenomenon in particular, we were doing research in Mexico with a group called Preventive Oncology International, with a guy at the Cleveland Clinic named Jerome Bellinson, who trained both of us actually, and his interest is in treating cancers in low resource settings. And we were in Mexico, which has had a pap smear program for the last 30 years that has made zero dent in treating cervix cancer, because poor training of the pathologists, you know, not having the resources that are needed. I mean, pap smear screening is a very resource intensive and specialized thing that we kind of take for granted here, and that's compounded with a lot of the women were from rural areas, and it's been kind of shown that they really will show up maybe once in their entire life for one pap smear, which is not how the screening program works. So you have these two problems that people are having a hard time getting around. And Preventive Oncology International is trying to develop a C screen and treat kind of approach, where can you get a diagnosis for a person in under an hour by basically running some of these genetic tests, rapid HPV profiling, and treat that person on the spot, usually with cryotherapy, which is where you kind of create this ice ball to freeze the cervix. It has low complications compared to surgery, where you cut the cervix off, because these people may go out back into the country and you never see them again. And so our study was kind of trying to set this up, work with the local community to recruit people and follow them over 2 years, which is challenging in and of itself. We had about 75% of people show up 2 years later to see how the treatment had resulted, and we didn't even have any cases of cervical dysplasia, which is the abnormality we were looking for, in these high-risk people that we had screened and treated previously. And so, you know, some of the idea too is trying to figure out, can we create a self-sampling device where people can almost, in a sense, do their own pap smears, where they could mail it in if they're from far away and get a result? And so there's ideas until the vaccine becomes available on a more global scale. And if a hepatitis vaccine is any indication, the hepatitis vaccine's any indication, that took about 30 years before it became affordable in places like Mexico and Peru. There has to be some stopgap solution between sort of now and then. And the PAP programs that have been in place around the globe just haven't been cutting it. And so there's a lot of interest in trying to figure out how can you, you know, how can you really screen and treat these people and maybe decrease the incidence till they can start getting the vaccine.
And then is this something then that you can take into other areas like reservations, like inner city, poor neighborhoods, those kinds of things?
I think that's the idea. We had initially, there was an attempt to try and sort of set it up in East Cleveland, which was kind of a poorer area mm-hmm. of Cleveland, but there are sites in Peru and China that are ongoing. In particular, we were setting up a site in the Amazon and then up in the Andes. There's a place in Peru called Iquitos. It's a city of 500,000 people. It's the only that can only be reached by plane or by boat. There are no roads to it. And so, I mean, that's an interesting place to sort of set this up. And so this is what kind of our mentor who we were training with, you know, it's his interest and it's some of the stuff we have participated
in. But it's a perfect approach for the Native American
for reservations.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Without a doubt.